Okay, so we're 7 weeks in to Deuteronomy, and we're at that point where I want to keep a decent clip things going so that week seven doesn't turn into week 52. So here's the deal. As we progress through, I may skip over some things, and if I do, and I happen to skip over something you had a question about, stop me. That's got to be the deal. That's got to be the way. The only way it's going to work is if you promise me that if there is something you don't understand and you want to understand, you'll raise your hand and say, "Hey, Scott, there's this verse back here. You didn't cover it." I know I'm not covering everything, but if there is something that just genuinely have a question about, definitely let me know, because we want to do that. But the book of Deuteronomy, being written in this kind of in-between time period, it's right here as they're at the edge of entering the territory down here at Mount Nebo, this area. They've not gone in yet, and yet the second generation is full grown and ready to go in. And so these are primarily three different speeches by Moses in order to get the people prepared, his final words of wisdom to them. We're in chapter 25, which shows you we're right down at the final stretch of the main section. And this is primarily focused on telling them about laws that they already know, but then also there are some additional instructions that are included along the way. So as we've gone through, we now get to chapter 25, and chapter 25 deals with a variety of things, but the primary section of chapter 25, down in verse 5, which is where we left off, deals with this particular responsibility to continue family lineages. Now, the reason for that was primarily due to the inheritances of the land. The boundaries of every tribe were based off of lineage. Each family had an allotment of land that would be set as the boundaries for that family and then divided up amongst each successive generation. And so when a man did not have children, that presented a problem in altering the long-term picture of the land succession. And so there was a system in place put for that. We've looked at part of that, in that there was the case where the man, he had only daughters. He said, "Oh, well, then the land goes to the daughters. They get the inheritance." But there was one stipulation for those daughters. They had to marry from within their tribe so that the land didn't leave the tribe and head to another tribe. In verse 5 of chapter 25 here, we deal with a different one, which is, when brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. So in this case, strange is outside of the family. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. It shall be, and here's the key, that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother, so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. So it was a way of continuing the lineage, that if a young couple gets married and he passes away before the family name is allowed to be passed down, she was to be married to the closest relative, which would have been brothers first, and then that firstborn son would then carry the name of the deceased brother. And it continues down saying, well, okay, well, as you progress, you're actually going to do it. What if there's no brothers? Well, then you would look for a closest relative. And we have a case of this in the Old Testament that's a pretty famous case of a woman marrying somebody else in the family lineage to carry on the name. And that's the case of Ruth. Ruth is a woman who was a widow, and she had no children. She was that Moabite woman that married an Israelite man. They had no children. He passed away. And then she moves back to the land of Israel and eventually ends up marrying Boaz. But if you remember in that story, and you go and look at it, before Boaz can marry her, he makes the statement that he wants to marry her, but there's one that is closer. And what he's referring to is somebody closer in the family lineage. And so as you read through Ruth, Boaz goes to that man, and the man gives up the right to take Ruth as his wife. And then there's this really weird thing with a sandal where he takes a sandal off and gives it to Boaz. And you go, well, why on earth is he taking his shoe off? Well, here in Deuteronomy 25 shows you why. In verse 7, if the man does not desire to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. He's not willing to perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. And then the elders of the city shall summon him and speak to him. And if he persists and says, I do not desire to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the sight of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face, and she shall declare, thus it is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. In Israel, his name shall be called the house of him whose sandal is removed. Now, in the case of Ruth and Boaz, it was quite clear that Boaz wanted to marry her. And so the man is giving up his right, as opposed to here where he's refusing. Right? This guy's refusing to do it in Deuteronomy 25. In the case of Boaz, Boaz really wants to marry Ruth, but he has to confer with the closer relative first. But he does, in the sight of the elders, take his sandal off. So that is reference back to this particular circumstance. So that's one of the cases where this law comes in place. The other time that it's of interest to us is in Matthew chapter 22, Jesus is asked by the Sadducees, who didn't believe in the resurrection. He said there was a woman and she was married to a man and they didn't have kids. And so then she married his brother and they didn't have kids. And then she married his brother and didn't have kids until she went through all the brothers. And then their question was, in the resurrection, who is she married to? If you remember that, that's from Matthew 22. And they did that to try and catch Jesus in a trick. Jesus' answer to that is, in the resurrection, there is no marrying. So all of these laws regarding marriage had nothing to do with long-term spiritual consequences. They had to do with physical consequences down here of the lineage of the family being established, which was a big deal under the Jewish law, and the boundaries of the land and all those sorts of things. It had nothing to do with spiritual consequences. The rest of the chapter deals with a couple of other things. Oh, you've got a question? Yes. Right. That isn't addressed in that passage, but no, you at that time they did have multiple wives. And in fact, Deuteronomy, as well as back in Exodus, covered laws that if you were to have multiple wives, you were not allowed to treat one better than the other. So that did happen. It was not God's original design, but it was something going on in the world at the time, polygamy. Right. Well, okay, so a couple of different things. One, there's more reasons why a man might not want a second wife. Without going into detail there, but I'll just let you kind of think about that yourself. And then the other is that the rights of the firstborn would have to now be split, because you're actually going to give a double portion to this kid who's now a firstborn but of your brother's lineage. So that would be another reason that he wouldn't want to do it. He didn't want to take on the responsibility and the dividing of his own possessions amongst another firstborn in that case. Any other comments or questions? Okay, so then further on down in this chapter, he deals with several different things. He deals with some things in terms of what do you do when people are fighting. Then there is a statement made about having just measures. In fact, starting in verse 13, there's about three, four verses there that deal with the idea of having just weights and measures. in a world that did not have standardized currency like we have today, their currency was based off of weight, because that is a standardized thing, which is really nice. Is you think about it, if you use a scale and you use the same scale for everything, it uniformly makes it fair. So let's say the scale is your own personal scale, of which people would have. They'd have their own personal scales for measuring things when they go to the marketplace. Let's say your scale's a little off. It's a little light. So when you measure your money out in silver or gold or whatever the case may be, it's going to come up a little light. But if you use that exact same scale for measuring the produce that you're going to get, what's going to happen with the produce? The money was light, but what's the produce? It's also light, right? So it's just, it's fair. Now, the thing you could do, though, is if you wanted to skim off the top, is you'd find a way to use one set of scales for measuring the money and another set of scales or weights for measuring the produce. And after all, the scale is just going to have two platforms on it. And so the weights, when he talks about just weights and measures, the weight is actually a uniform weight that you're going to put on that scale. Well, what if I have one weight that I put out when we're measuring the money that I know I'm going to pay you, and then when I go to measure the produce, I use a different weight that gives me an advantage. That's an abomination to God. In fact, verse 16 says, "For everyone who does these things, everyone who acts unjustly is an abomination to the Lord your God." It is, God looks at that sort of corruption and greed, because that's what is at the bottom of that, is greed and covetousness. And he says it's an abomination. Now, as you go through the Old Testament, abomination is not a word that's used all the time. There are things that God doesn't like or things that God says don't do, but it's a much smaller grouping of things that fit the category of being an abomination to the Lord. In fact, I think what you'll find is the things that are an abomination in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, guess what you find? They're also still wrong. There were some things that, like clean and unclean food in the Old Testament, that aren't carried over. But all those abominations you'll find are. That they're repeated in one shape or form in the New Testament. And so here's one of those, is that the idea of being dishonest is just something that God finds absolutely disgusting. Then the last thing that's mentioned in this chapter is this little anecdote about Amalek. And when they were coming in through the territory, if you go back through the journey in up to the point where they're at right now, there was a point where Amalek came out, and he was a king of the Amalekites, and he came out and tried to destroy them, and God protected them. And here in verse 17, it says, "Remember what Amalek did to you along the way when you came out from Egypt, how he met you along the way and attacked among you all the stragglers at your rear when you were faint and weary, and he did not fear God." So now we get a little extra detail about Amalek's attack of the Israelites. Not only did he attack them, but he did it in this, how do you put it? It's not real fair play, is it? It wasn't, hey, let's go to war. He caught the stragglers, the people who were weak, they were tired, and he'd pick on them. And it says that he came out and, you might say, kicked them when they were down. He didn't fear God. And so then God tells them, once you're settled in the land, you're going to go back to Amalek, which isn't part of the promised land. You're going to go back to Amalek's territory where the Amalekites are, and you will blot them out. Now, the guy who will be called to do that, and he says, don't forget. Well, looks like, in fact, they probably are going to forget, because God's going to have to command them to go back and do it. And the guy he commands to do it is King Saul. And if you remember that story when we get there, Saul's going to be told, wipe them all out. And what will Saul do? He won't wipe them all out. He'll take and save the best for himself and for the people. And so he'll get in a lot of trouble for that. But that goes all the way back to this commandment here in this particular verse. Okay, anything there or ready to move to chapter 26? Okay, so chapter 26 is going to primarily deal with tithing, that is the giving of 10%. We can sum up almost all of this chapter in saying God had an expectation that the Jews would give 10% of their harvest, of their produce, of the things that they had gained through their agricultural lifestyle. And it wasn't the last 10%, nor was it the 10% you didn't want, you know, the lame or the crippled, the produce that, you know, looks a little wormy, nothing like that. It was to be of the first fruits. So you look there in verse 10, and he says, "Now behold, I brought the first of the produce of the ground which you, O Lord, have given me, and you shall set it down before the Lord your God and worship before the Lord your God. And you and the Levite and the alien who is among you shall rejoice in all the good which the Lord your God has given you and your household." So when you're growing things and or ranching in the case of some of the tribes, that you don't wait till the end. You give of the first 10%, which is the hardest 10% to give of, because there's no guarantee of the other percentage showing up. You know, you give your first 10% of your crop, and you're making an assumption the other 90% will show up, but that may or may not be the case. Something could come in, and you could have a blight or locust or something like that that would destroy that. But you were to give of the first 10%, and you're to give thanks to God and set it before Him and worship Him. And the implication is when you would do that, and this chapter deals with that, when you do that, what does God say He'll do? He'll bless you because you gave it out of faith. You trusted Him and gave Him your first fruits and not your end. That principle of giving our first and best to God is just as true in the New Testament as it was in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, we're not told 10%. Tithing never shows up as a New Testament command, but in 1 Corinthians, when we're told to give, he says, "Lay by in store as you have prospered." So it's supposed to be a thoughtful process. So you're supposed to not look at it and say, "Well, what do I have left at the end of the month?" You're supposed to say, "Well, here's the first of the month, or in the case of Christians, the first of the week, and I've planned ahead what I'm going to give, and that's a thoughtful, cheerful giving process, trusting that the Lord will bless us." And so that was a principle that God laid out for generations with the Jews. And in the New Testament, that idea of trusting God in our financial things is just as true. That really is the bulk of what you'll find there in chapter 26. Anybody have any comments or questions? Okay, so that moves us really to the end of that particular section, that speech. And so then we move into chapter 27, and this is another one, and you can see that then Moses and the elders of Israel charged the people, saying, "Keep all the commandments which I command you today, and so it shall be on the day when you cross the Jordan, the land which the Lord your God gives you, that you shall set up for yourself large stones and coat them with lime and write on them all the words of this law when you cross over, so that you may enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, a land flowing with milk and honey, as the Lord, the God of your fathers, promised you." So you're to coat these rocks and with lime, write the words of law on them, so they are to be public monuments with the law on it. So if you were a Jew and you wanted to know what God's law was, these are public monuments that you could go up to and read the law. And he says in verse 4, "So it shall be when you cross the Jordan, you shall set up on Mount Ebal these stones, as I commanded you today, and you shall coat them with lime. Moreover, you shall build there an altar, Lord your God, an altar of stones. You shall not wield an iron tool on them. You shall build the altar, Lord your God, of uncut stones, and you shall offer on it burnt offerings to Lord your God. And you shall sacrifice peace offerings and eat there and rejoice before the Lord your God. You shall write on the stones all the words of this law very distinctly." That is, write the words of the law distinctly. That is, they're meant to be understood. They're meant to be read. This is a monument not just to be there, but so that people could access the knowledge of what the law was. So it could never be where the priest said, no, we know the law and nobody else does. Anybody who wanted to know God's law could. Now, they were to do this over at Mount Ebal, and there will also be Mount Gerizim. Now, that's over by Shechem, which is right in here, where that those monuments would be set up. And if you look, Mount Ebal, this is an overhead view. Mount Ebal is over here, and Mount Gerizim is over here. And these monuments were to be set up. And then what we're going to see as we progress through is that when they get into the land and the land is settled, okay, we've won the big battles and now we are the owners of this territory. What they were supposed to do was to have the people stay and go in the valley between these two mountains, which would become the town of Shechem. So as you can see there, it's about 1 mile across. And then you were to have people stand up on Mount Ebal and people stand up on Mount Gerizim and repeat the curses if you don't obey these laws that are written on this monument and the blessings if you do. Now, it's been studied and tested, as this chart points out, that in that town of Shechem, where that is, it is a natural amphitheater so that you could have thousands and thousands and thousands of people down there below, and then you could have people standing at the top of Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, and the sound would just carry right down there without any sort of amplification, just a natural acoustical process, and they could absolutely hear you because of the way that it forms this shape, this half circle, semicircle on both sides, would just send the sound right down there. So God tells them ahead of time, I want you to go have this ceremony, and I want everybody to hear. And he tells them to go to a place that they've never been, right? They've not been there yet. And you could be thinking, well, how can we make it so that everybody can hear, and we're going to do this? Well, God thought of that all ahead of time. It's a natural amphitheater. It's naturally set up for those sorts of things so that what they're going to be asked to do by God, they will be capable of doing, which is another truth we just need to kind of drive into our hearts. If God asks us to do something, he'll never ask us to do something that isn't possible to do. He's not in the business of creating impossibilities for you. You have to rely on him, but if we rely on him and follow him, then we can actually do it. So here in Deuteronomy 27, it's laid out what they're to do. And in the subsequent chapters, it will talk about the curses and the blessings. When you get to Joshua 8, when they've actually conquered the land, they're going to actually physically do this. So here is telling them what they should do when they conquer the land. In Joshua 8, they'll actually do it. Does that make sense? Anybody have any questions on that? Okay, so unsurprisingly, the curses will be laid out as being, if you don't follow God, here's the different things that will happen. And they are things that will affect every single area of your life. At first, he lays down the things that you are cursed if you do. Talks about you're cursed, and starting down about verse 15 of chapter 27. Cursed are you if you make an idol. Verse 16, we'll talk about honoring your parents. Cursed are you if you don't honor them. Cursed are you if you move your neighbor's boundary mark. In verse 17, that's going to become a factor for them, right? We just got done talking about how important it was to keep the family lineages around for those boundaries. What happens? I mean, you put all this work in having the genealogies just right, and then some guy goes out into the field, and there's a stone marker that's there for the surveying, and he just moves it over 10 feet. Well, you put all this work in to keep genealogies right, and then that guy undoes all of that with that amount of work. You just move the boundary line. So, no, that was a very deep, sinful thing. You were taking somebody's inheritance away, and God's boundaries for them. Another interesting one is verse 18. Cursed is he who misleads a blind person on the road. That's a very specific circumstance, isn't it? But it kind of points to a larger principle. You have a blind man on the road. He's pretty much dependent on everybody else giving him directions and help to get from where he is to where he needs to go. And for you to mislead him is very easy, but pretty despicable. And so there's a principle he's laying out there of that we'll see throughout the Old Testament and certainly throughout the New Testament, that when you have somebody who is needy, they more than anybody else deserves our kindest and deepest care. That you shouldn't ever use your authority or power to oppress or hurt another person. The following is something similar. Cursed is he who distorts the justice due an alien, an orphan, and a widow. Once again, three groups of people that would have been easily vulnerable to injustice. Verse 20 will deal with lying with your father's wife, that incest and adultery. 21 will deal with bestiality, and 22 also deal with more incest. And all the way down to verse 24, curses he who strikes his neighbor in secret, curses he who accepts a bribe to strike down an innocent person. And after each of these, it says, and all the people shall say amen. In other words, this is a recommitment to do that which we ought to do. And then it says, cursed, the last one is, cursed is he who does not confirm the words of this law by doing them. And that's an interesting point. How do you know that somebody has confirmed the words of God's law? They do it. The Old Testament, just like the New Testament, was never meant to be an academic process only. Yes, you had to learn it, but if you learned it and then you lived other than what God said, that's the not all what he intended. So you confirm God's law by living his law. Another way you might look at it is God tells us this is how things work. This is how you should live your life so it'll work. Well, how do you confirm that God's right? He tells you to live a certain way, and he says, if you live this way, you'll be happy. And so you go out and you do that thing. And then you confirm it, because guess what happens when you do it God's way? Turns out it works. It's kind of a nice deal. Those were all the curses. Chapter 28 will deal with the blessings, and significantly will point out all the things and areas of their life that they'll be blessed in if they follow God. Verse 3, you'll be blessed in the city and you'll be blessed in the country. Verse 4, the offspring of your body and the produce of your ground and the offspring of your beasts, the increase of your herd, the young of your flock, your basket, your kneading bowl, when you come in, when you go out, your enemies will run away from you. He'll talk about in verse 7. In other words, in every way and area of your life, you'll be blessed. He says in verse 12, the Lord will open for you, that is if you follow God and you keep his commandments. He says the Lord will open for you his good storehouse, the heavens, to give rain to your land in its season, to bless all the work of your hand, and you shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. It's interesting to me that God describes the heavens as his storehouse and then says, look, I'll be the one to give you the rain and the weather at the right time. No matter how powerful we've gotten as human beings, no matter how much dominion we have of the earth, we can dig into the deepest part of the earth and we can get gold and precious metal out of it. We can get oil for power. We can control just about everything and harness it. But how much control do we have over the weather? We're still just as completely dependent on the power and control of God for that now as we were before. Hurricane comes and hits the coast, and everybody, all they can do is say, brace for it. That's the most you could ever do. Because you don't have any control over his storehouses, the heavens. So he says, look, if you do that, I'll take care of you. He says, you'll lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. The Lord will make you the head and not the tail, and you only will be above and you will not be underneath if you listen to the commandments of the Lord your God, which I charge you today. And to observe them carefully, then verse 14 says, and do not turn aside from any of the words which I command you today to the right or to the left to go after other gods to serve them. So there's this reminder, disobedience is not merely... It's you can be disobedient by going to the right or to the left. That is, there's more than one way to get it wrong. You can get it wrong by adding a bunch of things to God's word. You can also get it wrong by ignoring things in God's word. You can get it wrong if you start doing a bunch of things you shouldn't do. But you also can get it wrong when you just don't do what you know. And so here, look, you're going to stay on that right path. Don't turn to the right or the left. Don't go after any other gods to serve them. So then verse 15, he goes back to looking at the curses again. And take a guess. What do you think will be the case? If you're blessed in the country and you're blessed in the city when you obey, what are you when you don't obey? You're cursed in the country and you're cursed in the city. And so he goes and lays down all of these various things. If you're blessed when your cattle are blessed and your crops are blessed when you follow God, when you don't follow God, guess what? Your cattle aren't blessed and your crops aren't blessed. And so it goes through every single thing. If you were, he says, you'll be above and never underneath if you're blessed, if you follow me. If you don't follow God, you'll never be above and you'll always be underneath. You'll always, he says, if you follow me as a nation, you'll always lend and you'll never borrow. If you don't follow me, guess what? You'll always borrow and you'll never have anything to lend. And so it on and on it goes that way. There'll be hostility and problems and all sorts of difficulties. And when we get to the book of Judges, that's exactly what we find happen. You'll have a generation that turns its back on God, and lo and behold, they get attacked and conquered and have all sorts of problems. Then God will send them a deliverer. The people turn back to God, and what happens? Everything starts getting better for a while until they forget about God again. So that's the pattern that he lays out for them. Let's see here. Is there anything else here in chapter 27 I'd like to focus on and emphasize? Here would be get down to the end of chapter, excuse me, not 27, 28. Chapter 28, get down about verse 66 and 67 sum up the curses quite nicely. He says, so your life shall hang in doubt before you, and you will be in dread night and day, and shall have no assurance of your life. In the morning you shall say, would that it were evening. And at evening you shall say, would that it were morning, because of the dread of your heart, which you dread, and for the sight of your eyes, which you will see. What's it like to live without God? Well, it is a life. You're not dead. But what's the quality of it? You're just trying to make it through the day. Oh, man, it's evening. I can't wait till morning. It's morning. I can't wait till evening. You know, get up in the morning and just hope you make it through the day. You get to the end of the day and you hope you make it through the night. And you're never comfortable. You have no sense of security. You have no sense of hope. And there's this constant sense of unease that you have to live with. Now, that could just as easily describe the life of a person without God today as it did back then. Because if you don't have God in your life, you have a life. But you don't have any of the tools to live that life, and you don't have any of the help of the creator of this world to help you through it. And so your life hangs in doubt, and you have dread, and you have no assurance, and you just try and make it one day after the other. And you're so miserable, you don't even realize you're miserable. That's what I find a lot of times is the case when we don't have God in our life. You're miserable, you're not happy, but you don't even realize how unhappy you are because you've been that way for so long. And it's you've been so long without hope that you forgot what it felt like to taste it. And that's what he tells them that they will have if they don't follow him. Anybody have any comments or questions before we move to chapter 29? Okay, so chapter 29, he says, these are the words of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the sons of Israel in the land of Moab, besides the covenant which he had made with them at Horeb. So if you remember, we're right down in this section here. So this is Moab, and so they've come up into this area, right? And he says, these are the words of that covenant that he made with them besides the one at Horeb. Now, where's Mount Horeb? Horeb's a name of a mountain. It has another name, though. What's the name? Its other name? Sinai. Yeah, Mount Sinai is back in the wilderness that they had been to out in Arabia. And so these are God renewing that covenant with them and reminding them, as well as it says, adding some things to that covenant here, words that were said, but not said at Horeb. And so then verse 2, it says, Moses summoned all Israel, and he said to them, you have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt to Pharaoh and all his servants and all his land, the great trials which your eyes have seen, those great signs and wonders. Yet to this day the Lord has not given you a heart to know, nor eyes to see, nor ears to hear. I've led you 40 years in the wilderness. Your clothes have not worn out on you, and your sandals not worn out on your foot. You've not eaten bread, nor have you drunk wine or strong drink, in order that you might know that I am the Lord your God. When you reach this place, Sihon the king of Heshbon and Og the king of Bashan came out to meet us for battle, but we defeated them, and we took their land. So he reminds them, how did you get here in this spot right now? It's all been through God, and you think about it. Jen and I were talking about this time period, and it hit her, and so I'm going to give her credit because I didn't think of it. But she said, all of the people alive there were wearing dead men's clothes. You know, that's really true. They're out there in the wilderness, the second generation, and they're wearing the shoes and the clothes that had been on the feet of the generation that had died. And God says they hadn't worn out. Now, God says, you've been through all that. You saw what happened in Egypt. You've seen how I've conquered here. But then he also says in verse 4, yet to this day the Lord's not given you a heart to know, nor eyes to see, nor ears to hear. That'll actually be quoted in Romans 11 about this idea of people just not understanding the will of God. They've been through so much, and yet he says, you still don't get it. Now that's interesting to me, because this generation that's going to take in the land, are they a good generation or a bad generation? They're a good generation. They're much better than the last one, aren't they? And yet he says, you still don't really understand the God you serve. And we'll find that to be true. They understand it better than their parents did. They're more faithful than their parents. But when they go in to conquer the land, God tells them, wipe them all out and conquer every corner. Are they going to do that? No, they're going to leave some people there because they're going to say it's too hard. Well, if they really understood deep in their heart who their God is, would they say, no, we can't conquer that. It's too hard. They'd never say that. They would understand, if God has told us to do it, we can do it. Now, they're better than their parents, but there was still room. He says, you don't get it. And I think about passages like that, and it makes me wonder about myself. I'd like to think I'm a faithful man. I'd like to think that I trust the Lord. But there are times where I think I couldn't do that. And really, when I say I couldn't do that, what I'm really saying is I don't understand who my God is. I don't have enough appreciation for who he is, because it has nothing to do with me at all. It has everything to do with his character. If he tells you go up and take the land, you go up and take the land. And so he's laying out for them this history once again as a reminder, look, you can do it. And yet you're going to have doubts. And there's going to be times where you should go and conquer them, and you say, no, we can't take that city. It's too difficult. The walls are too fortified, or the hill country's hard. The people are difficult to root out of there. And he said, no, you've forgotten who I am. That's his point. Now, throughout the rest of this chapter, he's going to reiterate that idea. And he'll tell them, I've made a covenant with you. I've made an oath with you. And in fact, in verse 10, he says, you stand today, all of you, before the Lord your God. Your chiefs, your tribes, your elders, your officers, even all the men of Israel. Your little ones, your wives, the alien who's within your camps, from the one who chops your wood to the one who draws your water, that you may enter into the covenant with the Lord your God and into his oath, which the Lord your God is making with you today, in order that he may establish you today as his people, and that he may be your God, just as he spoke to you and as he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, has God already made a covenant with the children of Israel to give them the land? Absolutely. But this generation's now going to do it. And when that covenant was made, how old were they? They were just babes if they were even born at all. Right? Very few of them would have even remembered being at Mount Sinai. So what he's saying is, I'm with you. All of you who are physically here right now, let's make the agreement again. I've made a covenant. I've told you I'll do my part. Will you do your part? And so he's you might call it a renewing of the vows as you have a new generation that is ready to go in and take the land. Let's see here. Down verse 14, he says, now not with you alone am I making this covenant and this oath, but both with those who stand here with us today in the presence of the Lord our God, and with those who are not with us here today, for you know how we lived in the land of Egypt, and how we came through the midst of the nations through which you passed. So this is a promise that he says, I'm making this with you here, but I also made it with the generations before. And but you know how that worked out for them. So the covenant with the previous generation is the same one I'm making with you, but how did it turn out for the previous generation? They didn't follow me, and so they all died in the wilderness. So the implication is, I'm making the same covenant with you, so what's going to be the important ingredient that you need to pay attention to, this new generation of Israelites? Yeah, you be obedient, right? You do it. You do what mom and dad didn't do. And so then down verse 22, he says, the generation to come, your sons who rise up after you and the foreigner who comes from a distant land, when they see the plagues of the land and the diseases which the Lord has afflicted, will say, all its land is brimstone and salt, a burning waste, unsown and unproductive, and no grass grows in it, like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah. Which the Lord overthrew in his anger and his wrath. All the nations will say, why has the Lord done thus to this land? Why this great outburst of anger? So he lays out, look, there will come a time where your people will not follow me. So when you follow me, you're blessed. Right? That's what Gerizim says. When you don't follow me, you're cursed. And if you're cursed long enough, your kids, they're going to learn the lesson of how strong God is by looking at how fouled up things are when you didn't obey. They're going to look at this wonderful land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and say, this is a burning wasteland. How did it get like this? And the answer is, how did it get like that? Your disobedience. That's right. It's the Mount Ebal curses. Just a few more interesting things, because we're right here at time, and we'll close up at the end of chapter 29. But he says that even the people around at that time will say the reason is, in verse 25, because they forsook the covenant of the Lord, the God of their fathers, which he made with them when he brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went and served other gods and worshiped them. The greatest problem that they're going to face as a nation is idolatry, serving other gods. If they can keep themselves out of idolatry, they'll be fine. But they just cannot seem to do it. It infiltrates them every time. And then at the very end, in Deuteronomy 29:29, this is probably one of the most quoted verses of Deuteronomy, he says, the secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the things revealed belong to us and to our sons forever, that we may observe all the words of this law. Now, I quote that whenever there's a Bible question that you ask and I don't know the answer to. I just go, well, the secret things belong to God. I don't have an answer. So it's a very, very useful preacher verse. But the context of it is, what he's telling them is, don't you worry about all these other things that you don't know anything about. You don't have to worry about stuff you don't know anything about. The secret things belong to God. If you don't, there's a great unknown in every human being's life. Plenty of things you don't understand and you can't comprehend. In fact, God has said, worry about how much? How much time do you worry about? Yeah, just worry about one day. Tomorrow has its own trouble. Just each day has enough trouble of its own. Secret things belong to God. You worry about one thing. The things revealed belong to us and our sons forever. His word that he has revealed to us, that's what we focus on. And let him take care of the rest. And if you do that, then you'll be a blessed nation. You'll have all the blessings of Gerizim and none of the curses of Ebal. Does anybody have any comments or questions there? Okay, then we'll close down there. And then next week we'll look at chapter 30 through the rest of the book, which really lays out what the history of the Israelites will look like if they don't remember to follow God. And he lays out that history because he knows that, in fact, that's exactly what will happen. So we'll close down there and pick up Deuteronomy 30 next week.